Hello and welcome to this edition of the Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition podcast, sponsored by the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. I'm Brian O'Connor, adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at Chicago Booth. And joining me today, I have the pleasure of talking to Rob Swanson, a fantastic and intriguing entrepreneur. He is the founder, president, and CEO leading up to its ultimate sale last year of RAS & Associates, a Denver-based specialized consulting firm. Rob has a fascinating story, and we're thrilled to have him here today with us to talk a little bit about growth and scaling of his business and ultimately the exit decision and thought process around all of that. Rob, thank you for joining us. We also have Alex Hodgkin, who is the executive producer of this Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition podcast, joining us in a cameo role on today's episode. So, Alex, thanks for sitting in and joining us.
Very, very happy to be here, Brian. Thank you for letting me participate today.
Great, great. Hey, Rob, Alex, not that your story isn't equally fascinating. let's start with Rob. Rob, could you share with us just a little bit of background and your story, how you kind of came into founding RAS & Associates, and a little bit about that business, if you would?
Sure. No, thanks for having me, and appreciate the Polsky Group inviting me in to discuss my journey and talk more about what you all are doing here. But I grew up in Colorado and went to school at Colorado State University undergrad, then went as an industrial engineer into the corporate world, came out a finance guy, then went and did business school at Georgetown and thought I was going to be a banker, came out a consultant. And so for about 4 or 5 years in management consulting, started to, you know, make my way up the ranks, and then ultimately decided to start a firm. The kind of crux of that, or nexus, was I felt like there were some unmet needs in the market. And I don't know if it was, you know, spite or a challenge or me being naive or, you know, kind of rock-headed, thought we could build a better firm and go compete with some of the large global consultancies. So that happened in 2008, early 2008, and we built the firm initially in aerospace and defense and telecom and cable, and that led to high tech, started to grow successfully. Eventually added oil and gas and some startup type entities, and had a great time doing it. It certainly wasn't without drama, terrible decisions, both business and personal, and then kind of a rebirth at about year 6-7, and then getting very focused on how do we optimize not only the business, but, you know, kind of the people leading it, and then position it for sale, and then ultimately doing an exit about a year and a half ago, or the beginning of 2017.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, let's talk a little bit about founding your business in 2008. Mm-hmm. A little bit of discussion around what that might have been like.
Yeah, so, you know, I'd like to go back and say that, you know, I strategically determined that in a terrible economic cycle that I had the gumption to, you know, throw it all on the table and cash out my 401k. I don't know if I was.
Did you execute on a fully developed business plan when you decided to launch this venture, Rob, or was this?
It was developed. I don't know if it was, what my business school professors would have approved or anyone at that time would have funded. But, you know, you need some luck and you need hard work. And I had, fortunately, I never had a problem, you know, going all in if I believed in something. And so, you know, for those that are debating, like, you know, to go do this, like, you know, necessity will do a ton for your creativity. So at the end of 07 or all of 2007, I was kind of lost. So I was still, you know, in my 30s, still relatively fresh out of business school, you know, still full of, like, I can take on the world. I got these MBA strategies figured out. And had interviewed to be kind of a corporate development or strategy guy at a lot of other organizations. And then ultimately was like, I'm checking out. And then, you know, 30 days later, I don't know if I manifested or what, but I was fortunate enough to land a client. And then I had to get a tax ID number and a website and started literally growing from there. And so, took out money from savings and figured it out. And there were some unique things that are kind of trivial that worked in my favor, but there was a, you know, kind of a dual carve out coming out of two aerospace giants that, you know, landed in my lap. It was a world that I knew, kind of both on the finance and engineering side, and then that was it. And so, you know, in 08, that was one area of the economy that was still rather robust, if there were any areas of the economy. So we were fortunate, but we worked hard and then slowly scaled the team up in 08.
Yeah. So you founded the business in 2008. Right out of the gates, you had a client. Therefore, you had a company with 100% customer concentration. How did you think about the growth into new accounts, scaling the team? I mean, the early days, Rob, your story is fascinating. Share with us a little bit of maybe some anecdotes from those early days and diversifying your customer base and hiring your first handful of employees.
Yeah, so customer concentration, it's like, you know, hey, congratulations. We were lucky enough. We were a seven-figure business in our first year and had complete customer concentration. And in fact, that pie was growing bigger, but there were still zero slices. And it was a slice of pie. And as you kind of lay back or lean back on your MBA experience, you know, all of a sudden you're, I don't know if it's at the early stages kind of a keep at night, but like you can't stop thinking. How do we do this? How do we get into this? And so the first year I really focused on making sure we could see beyond, 2008 into 09, because I started to hire people and we wanted everyone to rep our colors. So we didn't do any 1099. I wanted people to work for us. And in hindsight, I don't know if I would have done it that way because that risk was all on me, but I needed people to believe in our brand. So we worked hard on core values. And we had this kind of chip on your shoulder, like we've got to be able to go toe to toe with the global consultancies. And we did. And I think our clients appreciated that focus without all of the hoopla of, brand and pageantry and the nine partners calling them. The way we scaled it, though, was a lot of process. So we did a significant amount of documentation of how explicit things would work and around financing and growing. Financing, I originally went out and got a line of credit. So, we had our working capital model, you focus on cash and went out and got a line of credit, which was very challenging in 2008 and 2009 with a service business that really could only be secured with my waning personal assets that were invested in the business from my very small 401k. That being said, I think there was also a time in 08 where we were fortunate with attracting really hungry consultants. Because the global consultancies were kind of struggling as well. So, clients were scaling down big projects, both in the strategy and kind of big five world. And, call it luck or timing, what have you, but our first, 10 employees turned out to be not only incredible, critical thinking consultants that wanted to be in the middle of confusing projects, but they still remain to be friends. I mean, we were all kind of in it together and we were putting indelible fingerprints on the walls of our company. And, and there were stories then about this conference room at this client. It was really our corporate headquarters at our one client. So at night, what I did was I was out meeting people. And so, reaching out to connectors, figuring out the business world. And so there's a real duality there in like, hey, you're running the business during the day and at night you've got to create more, because that takes time in the service world to get people to convince them, like, who are you again? Like, what do you do? Like, why would I pay you? So I was probably not very good at it then, but was hungry and persistent, and it took time. And then, we landed Quest Telecommunications. And then we started to make our way into oil and gas. Oil was going bananas. And so every year we did do a very MBA-like thing in the third quarter. We would spend about a month looking at what the next 2 to 3 years look like and scaling that out. And then we would ask the dark hallway questions of like, how or why is this not going to work? What's going to break? Who's going to break? And so it wasn't perfect, but we, you know, we more or less were able to avoid, you know, certain disaster. Not that there weren't moments where I was like, you know, shut it down. But for sure, that foresight and then, you know, living up to that, you know, it was, we did a pretty good job, and I was proud of that plan.
Sure. And it sounds like that core team continued to be instrumental in the growth and the success of your company. You know, Rob, you and I have talked a little bit about culture, and you know, specifically a quote that I gravitate to that you said in one of our conversations is culture tied to performance metrics. Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about that, because it would be very easy, right, for you to compromise the culture and the synergy and the bond that you had with that core team in an environment where you're growing like a weed, you know.
Yep.
And so let's talk a little bit about the specifics of that culture, and maybe even more specifically about culture tied to performance metrics, because you don't hear that a lot, right? You don't mix and mingle the notion of culture and measurement. I love both of them, but you don't often hear them in the same context.
No, it's hard, and I don't know if we had it all figured out, but there's one story that I will share that kind of galvanizes the questions you're asking. And culturally, we had we had three core values, and there was really one that, you know, dominated, and it was, you know, make your own opportunity. And before I had started this firm, I really thought mission, vision, values was a bunch of stuff that, you know, not people in finance and strategy would just make up to validate their existence. And when I started our venture, I could see, like, you know, I really wanted to listen. And I think I was kind of going through a self-awareness period as well. So make your own opportunity, like, what does that actually mean? And so there's a story that kind of evolved at our firm, and it was represented by our ultimate mascot, which was a mountain lion. And I went out, and someone in our group, I was looking to procure a legitimate stuffed taxidermied mountain lion, and her name was Karen. And Karen is still in my basement, and certain people wish Karen wasn't. But
Karen, the stuffed mountain lion. For clarification, it's not keeping.
We rescued her. No, it's not a real. There's not a live apex predator in my basement. But what I loved about the metaphor or the vision of Karen was that if you look at mountain lion, I was fascinated, like, you know, growing up in Colorado. But if those animals don't execute, like when they're hunting, they don't eat. And so, you know, you can see the intensity in the eyes and in the way they're created and what have you. So I would talk about with our teams, like, you have to be prepared. You have to be well-read. All of these things are ante. Like, if we're going to go up against a global strategy firm or an Accenture, they have better brand. They have more money. They've got too many employees. And we're going to kind of a judo strategy. We're going to use their strengths against them. And so we're going to be nimble. We're going to be focused. And when it's there, we're going to go in for the kill. And so that really kind of manifested culturally what I wanted in our team. Now, certainly I can point at examples where I wanted, you know, people to act, not ask for permission. And so if you were sitting on your hands at our firm, it wasn't going to work. Like, I'm not going to have it. So we became very sales focused, very relationship focused. We finally purchased or got Salesforce, and we tracked the activities from a sales thing, and we created an EBIT pool that we would measure and then share on a monthly basis to the team of, like, here's where we're at, here's the plan. Everyone has responsibility. So we would do kind of a team bottoms up buildup of a revenue plan, set certain measures on cash, gross profit, and EBIT. And then we knew kind of win rates explicitly, and that, you know, it's a numbers game. But if we can differentiate in our focus, maybe we can tweak the odds in our favor, especially in the sales process. So we built a very, you know, psychology focused approach with our clients. We really tried to understand what they were doing. And so at meeting time, all of those things had gone well. And everyone knew on my team what it was in for them.
Sure.
And it wasn't, you know, perfect, but it kind of eliminated a lot of BS on like, well, what am I supposed to do? I mean, it got real simple.
No, what gets measured gets done.
Right.
And if the clearer you can be about what's being measured, what the goal is against that measurement, I think that it just makes everybody's life a little bit easier. Sounds like, and it sounds like your team sort of rallied around that so much so that they saw a participation in EBIT as the goals were being met and exceeded.
And I think on the employee side, or you know, our colleagues or teammates, what I think it also unlocked in them was a sense of like, I'm in this game. Right. At a larger, you know, bank or consulting for any company. Right. Like, you don't really know what's going on behind the curtain. My goal was like, I'm going to dispel the myth. Like, I pull the curtain. Here's how this works. Right. Like, here's how a $1 million deal is identified, sold, closed, won, delivered. And then where's the next one coming from?
Yep.
Not this mythical thing of like, you know, hey, I'm a consultant and then this project's done. Now I wait to get told to go to the next project. I would much rather have, you know, a 28-year-old laser focused on like how this game's played, because they're going to be better off for our group. And by the time they're 30, 32, compared to the 32-year-old at some other firm, they're going to be way more equipped. They're going to have been around the track a number of times. So we're going to beat them on the curve in sales development, professional development, and then keeping them like they're you're part of our DNA. I want you to own this like it's your own, not to just, you know, be a passive employee.
I thought you know, maybe an interesting area to explore is, you had mentioned this, I think, Rob, in you know, there was a certain point where the company had kind of stagnated, and you refer to those as the teenage years.
Yep.
And how then there was a maturation process that prepared the company for sort of, you know, that final trajectory that then led to the ultimate exit. Yep. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what teenage years meant, and then how you pushed through to kind of get to that next level.
Yeah, so important, because there's so many smart people out there, and I think a couple things happened. One was the oil markets crashing in 2014. Another was, you know, I got into a kind of a CEO forum group, and really started to absolutely invest in me getting better, like across, like the whole thing. And what happened at the end of year three and four was like, we flattened out. And so I was paying I was doing an entrepreneur program actually here in Chicago called Strategic Coach. A guy named Dan Solomon runs it. And I had these one-off sessions, and he said one of his senior leaders said to me, he goes, well, maybe just fish were jumping in your boat. And like, you know, and talk about like, you know, your ego going like, are you kidding me? Like, I've built this, you know, kick-ass business. You don't, you know, you're not a consultant. You don't, I mean, like all the.
Well, I built that boat, mister.
Yeah. And I was like, he's right. Like in some ways, you know, we absolutely had done incredible things, but it kind of like forced me to get better. And so we did. And so what I ended up looking at doing is like, well, what service lines can we add? How can we get even more focused? Do we need financing to go do that? Do we look at M&A, which we looked at and acquired a very small venture to go off and do that? And then, or do we start to look at, you know, if we were acquired or partnered up with somebody else, could we get to the same points faster without compromising, you know, how we want to run our business? So it was kind of like a massive self-awareness period. And like the advice I would give is that the more people you can surround yourself with that are going to proactively challenge you, be it like on your health, you know, work-life balance, which I think is a BS term. It's about choice. How do you prioritize, and what are you going to focus on, and what are you ultimately going to attract? And not to get all like Zen Buddhist on you, but like, you know, I believe in a lot of ways I started to get really clear, both mentally and physically and with business. And so That meant attracting the right clients, the right employees, but also we had to get better. And that's a difficult thing to hear. Denver, a lot of our work was about 60% of our work was in Denver, and then the rest of it was across the country. Denver's not a Chicago. It's maybe a top 20 economy. So you really had to want it. Everyone wants to live in Denver. So how are you going to differentiate, and how are you going to get even more clear on that focus strategy so that those teenage years, kind of 4 to 6 and then 7 were, me refiguring out like what I ultimately wanted to be, how I wanted to run this business. Could we scale it? The ceiling of complexity of like, why are we not growing anymore? Why can't this person do that? And
I think these are interesting things to dig in on, especially given the focus of our series is entrepreneurship through acquisition, because a lot of folks that are looking to sort of, go down this career path are going to be looking at businesses, that maybe in sort of, these teenage years are stagnating or, there's going to be, obviously there have to be, opportunities for value creation as that might be the appropriate term here. And so, go into those in a little bit of detail just so people can be thinking about that.
Yeah. So, for me, and, I kind of grew up as an engineer and finance guy, I always looked at like, we need the financial ability to go out and attack all the time. And so we held a very conservative, cash model. I had all kinds of capital we could deploy. And so kind of creating this strategic vision of like going out and looking and meeting other, colleagues, competitors, really understanding what's going on. And then the adjacent industries and groups that are doing that, you've got to know who those people are, and you never know, right? You never know if you're going to be partners or foes or both. That was a thing. And then I really started to invest probably in years 6 and 7 to look at, what would a group like ours trade at? I mean, like legitimately, and what if we got to the next level and the next level, and how would we architect that? Those were all things that I knew that if we had the financial ability, and then if I could, to your point, Alex, like really start to clear out time to think through those things critically and then bring them to my forum group or my attorney or a banker, that whether I did anything or not, I felt like we were on top of our game.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, talk a little bit about your concept that you shared, and maybe this sort of came to be during the teenage years, if you will, of your business. But your focus on 3 days in any given week, it's a fascinating concept that I think our listeners could really learn from.
Yeah, and we kind of modified this to what worked for us, but it was something that I did again from the strategic coach stuff, and a lot of entrepreneur programs have this, but I really tried to boil down 3 days, and it's interesting. It's probably interesting to hear from all the people you interview, but the 3 days go like this. The number one most important day is kind of your finance or focus day. This is the day where all of your hard work, it's like game day. Like I'm pitching, it's a revenue closing day, or it's a setup to that. So if we were meeting with the CEO of this company or that company, it's all the prep that in order to pitch the deal or close it or what have you. The other type of day was called a buffer day. And so the buffer day was all the preparation for that and or internal projects. So whether it was, improving AR or recruiting or cultural events or our employee review process, my team, a lot of people, I'd say the leadership team knew how I structured those days. But for my directors, which were a huge part of our success, and managers and associates, understanding what internal things that we were architecting, well, those were done on buffer days and those were figured out and we would spend on time on that. And the final day, which was the teenage period, which I was terrible at, was the free day. And that's like, you got to shut it all down and you got to go have fun. And I was pretty much awful at those the first 4 or 5 years because I worked. And I think in hindsight, I probably could have done a better job of balancing that. And there were a lot of negative ramifications of that, be it health and relationships. But like there's trades, like, management consulting and, you know, banking in particular, like there aren't hours in the day or days in the week. It's like if a client wants calls you on Sunday, like you're probably going to go meet that client. Yeah. So those 3 days, I would start off, I would do the list on Monday. And then it would also kind of fold into the strategic planning. So in the third quarter, we would start to peel back and then we would chunk it out by quarter. And I should have brought it, but I still have these plans from like 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, where I had the year planned out, the quarterly goals. And honestly, all of those goals, most of those goals happened. I still don't ski 60 days a year, which is a shame. And I still don't surf 60 days a year. So, but I don't actually have, you know, any amount of excuses to not do those things. But I think getting real clear on, like, what is the outcome you want and starting backwards, those days set you up to do that.
Yeah. So this is actually something that our listeners probably, especially the ones that are about to acquire and run a business or the ones that are currently out there running a business. I mean, like you said, it's very easy to take a client call on a Sunday and you know, make that a priority for a day that maybe should have been reserved for something else.
Yep.
You made a comment about sort of this notion of work life, but really it's more about choices and prioritization. Talk through, obviously, Rob, it seems like, you know, that was something that, you know, you didn't have early on in this. It wasn't a 2008 thing. This was like a 2015 type of thing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, walk us through that, your learning in that, and maybe some words of wisdom for folks that find themselves struggling with the options and their prioritization of those options.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the big lie or thing that's sold, especially, you know, especially coming out as a newly minted MBA. I mean, it's supposed to be about, you know, your vision, you're spiking the football in the end zone, you close the deal, you know, 100 times X, like all these things. And so there's the brains going like, well, you know, hey, I'm not doing anything. I should be focused on, you know, achieving, earning, killing it, slaying. I mean, all of those things. And I was no different. And I was wholly bought into that kind of that experience. And I think even now, I still work with, like, you know, a life coach, and I have very clear people advising me. My forum group's still very important. Making sure that the personal itch is scratched and kind of paying yourself first. Because if not, you start to, like, lose a massive part of yourself. Because as you get older, your experience in life's going to be different with relationship or kids or what have you. You know, like in hindsight, you know, I had my grandpa on my dad's side never had debt, and I never really understood. And I don't think he just liked debt. Right? It's that generation just didn't, they paid with cash. And I don't know if that's in my DNA, but I hated owing a lot of people money. And I think in some ways that might have limited the growth of the firm, because I only took, you know, some investments on a very limited basis. It was, I didn't give up control. I didn't give up this. But I think also creatively, you know, that obstinance might have, like, deterred that. But at the same time, really making sure that, like, you know, I started to meditate. I started to kind of re-fall in love with skiing again. I would golf only for work, which started to become, you know, more of a chore than a fun thing. And there's a saying, like, you know, don't kill your passion or your hobbies by making it exactly what you do. I wasn't doing any of that. And so kind of reassessing who you are and what you want. And I think in college and even in high school and, you know, in primary school, we don't do a good job, like, really understanding, like, what you want to do and what you want to go and be. And, like, you know, if someone asked me, like, well, why did you go to business school? I was like, I mean, like, honestly, I loved the movie Wall Street, and, like, there was something about that writing that I was like, God, that looks like incredible fun. And it was, until it's not.
Yeah. Rob, and you're wearing very nice suspenders, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Bud Fox. gecko. But those things, I think, and then carving out a space and a team of people, because I think like Forum, whether it's EO or YPO, it doesn't really matter. Like, can you learn from other people going through the same thing, but also then have, you know, someone that's been around the track a bunch of times to go like, hey, you know, can I share something with you? Like, you know, when you're taking money, like, you know, when you're done with that, like, make sure you feel okay with that giving up control, because here's what that means in 3 years.
Yeah.
You can read a term sheet and in a purchase agreement, but until you've actually lived it, you don't really have a clue. And so if it's always measured in those economic terms, I mean, that's a way to measure. And that was the way I only measured for a while. And then figuring out like, okay, well, what do I want? Because I believe you can have it all. And, you know, what we talked about earlier was I started to measure all the kind of domains of my life, be it, you know, health, joy, kids, you know, relationship, work. Because I didn't want to like, well, I'm just not going to like check out of the work world. Like, I'll be bored. So like, how are you doing all those things? And what are you measuring there?
Yeah.
Right? Because if
yeah.
you're not, I agree with you, you're not doing it then. So I had to really take a lot of what I did in consulting and like aim it back at my life.
Yeah.
Well, fascinating discussion. I don't think we spend enough time on this podcast talking to operators that struggle with prioritization and choices and this notion of balance and what's important, business related or otherwise. So I appreciate you sharing
sure.
your insights there. Maybe to kind of wrap up, let's get back to RAS for a second
sure.
and talk through sort of the growth through those the teenage years and into kind of the stage where you started thinking about an exit and how you thought about that. What were the key considerations? Maybe give us whatever information and detail you're able to or willing to share around the exit of RAS last year.
Yeah, definitely. So probably, you know, in the mature years, I guess, I don't know if I ever ultimately matured, but when I really started to understand, you know, the different banks research written on our industry, what really kind of sparked that was I had an accounting firm approach us, and they kind of casually had said like, well, look, we've got this. They basically said we're not able to grow, and so, you know, I was like, well, what do you guys want? Like, what do you talk to me for? And they're like, well, we think you could help us grow, and we'd be interested in acquiring you. And so, you know, we exchanged, you know, kind of, you know, information, and I, you know, kind of saw where they were going. And that got me, that was like the spark that like triggered, like, I really need to understand how and what we could be worth today, tomorrow, and the next year if we executed our strategy. So I had, you know, been introduced to a number of buyers. I did not have a banker at the time. I was using kind of our law firm and some, you know, other MBA friends that are bankers to kind of help me guide through it. Came close, was under LOI, and then ultimately it didn't work out. And then finally decided that I needed to go get a banker. I interviewed a significant number of bankers, found a couple, two that I liked, and then ultimately picked one. And then, you know, we took a step back, you know, ran the financials, put the deck together, went to market, and ran a process, and ended up using a bank in Denver called GLC Advisors, and
sure.
then used our law firm, Brownstein, and yeah, went smooth, and was a great transaction. I learned, you know, probably, you know, as much from the bankers and the lawyers going through that process, and admittedly just amazed at how good a team I had seen, like the night before, like all the challenges, and then the next day just incredibleness the next day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
just really appreciated that team, knowing they were as committed as I was.
Yeah, I've been in that position, and it's a moment of pride when you see that all come together like that.
Yeah, trust in that, especially when, you know, I had bought out a partner maybe 3 years before the close, and that was a big decision as well financially. So, you know, I was not levered up, but like, you know, I owed, and the business needed to perform, And so it did, and I had a great team, and there were bumps along the way, and you get asked all the questions that, you know, when you're going through the road shows, you're like, have I addressed this with this group already, and making sure everything's incredible? You have industry concentration or this, or how come you're not this? In the back of your mind, you're going like, come on, man. Like, you know the size of our company, you know. So learning how that worked and having advised on it through either, you know, pre-merger or merger integration, sure, as a consultant, it's very different when it's you because your emotions are engaged.
Yeah, yeah. What was important to you in a buyer?
I mean, valuation for sure. I think the other thing then was, could we sustain our team on the other side? And then finally, could we still have authorship to create? And so that was really important to me. I didn't know, you really don't know the third one until you're, you know, 3 to 6, 9 months in. And I felt like we made a really good decision there. And when they're selling you on, you know, all the companies they went and met with, you know, everything's incredible and, you know, da da. And, you know, you do your due diligence as well. So you need to make sure that jives and meet as many people as possible going through that. And so I think those are the three primary things. And then just being like, am I really doing this? I mean, like, legitimately, could I see myself working there? Could I report to this team?
And yeah. I would say we also, you know, we look at a number of different business models in these episodes. And specifically here, we're talking about, you know, professional services or business services. And maybe, Rob, can you share a little bit about what the unique drivers to valuation are for your business, as a, you know, kind of is compared to, you know, other companies or other business models?
Yeah. I mean, the main driver, I mean, there were kind of bookends on valuation. So EBIT was, you know, the one that most groups used. And then we had very high EBIT comparatively to firms, sub $50 million. But what I learned the industry also did was that revenue multiple would also be to kind of like beat you back down. And so I had to, you know, kind of tweak the knobs on that to see what was optimal. The other thing was that I felt we did incredibly well, and I think we got valued on, was the way we went to market, meaning, you know, kind of going back to the mountain lion, right? And I think all the potential buyers that we met with loved that metaphor. I think they saw hunger, they saw focus, they saw, you know, all the things I saw in Karen the cougar. But it's really important because if we did anything from a value driver and focus, it was on relationship building and revenue generation with very big companies. So we didn't go after, you know, middle market. Or I went like, look, these companies use a lot of consultants. They pay a lot of consultants. I try to get as much recurring revenue as possible. You know, 15 to 20% of our work was really directional strategy. But strategy has a beginning, middle, and end, and it's done. Then there's the execution. So our bread was buttered on the execution, whether we did the strategy and then implemented, or, you know, McKinsey, Bain, or BCG did it, because at a, you know, $50 billion company, they're not going to like, oh, yeah, you know, the board's going like, you know, get RAS in here. So we knew who we were, and then we knew how to optimize an executive's concern. And we had very discrete steps in our sales methodology and our approach. We measured those things in conversation. So, you know, towards the end, I think, you know, I got very good at this through messing it up, quite honestly, a lot. But then when we would talk through with the buyers about, how do you guys work with a Lockheed Martin or a Charter or what have you? And so I could say, like, exactly, here's exactly how we built that relationship. And kind of put it back to you, like, this is our brand, right? And so if you call them right now, they'll take our call and they'll tell you the amazing work that we've done. And so I don't know if every firm could do that. I think a lot of them kind of have that network effect of, like, they get to the size and brand. But I felt like, you know, we had very committed mountain lion people that they believed. And that was a differentiator in our approach.
And ultimately the buyer and the final sort of partner that you decided to go with understood and appreciated the value that that represented for them as a firm and were willing to pay for it, presumably.
Definitely. And I think we also had very formative opinions on how that, I mean, like very strong opinions on how that worked, because once we dialed it in, we tried to replicate it. So like, for instance, the way we trained it was we would invite not-for-profits in Denver, Goodwill, A Scholarships, the Tennyson Center, with their executive teams. And I would have my consultants interview their executive team using our approach. And then they would, part of their, you know, my team, we gave back a lot to the community. They would build the strategy for the executive team in a day. And so it would be kind of this speed, you know, selling, but like everyone's learning, everyone's getting benefit and value. And so that was a muscle that, you know, I would challenge people on. And every Friday mornings, we would go around the room energetically. I would ask people like, what's, you know, it was called positive focus. So like you would share what's going well in your life. We'd go around the room is buzzing. And then we would very quickly get into the sales pipeline, and it wouldn't be like, oh, you know, had a cool meeting with da da da. It would be like, what are the next three steps to close? And Salesforce would be open, and it would be diabolical. And we could get through our whole pipeline, which was significant, in like 30 minutes.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Well, Rob, your story is amazing. Congrats on all your success. You've built a fantastic company. What does life look like now?
So I have, Alex lives in Denver. So, I did ski quite a bit last year and fished and I picked up surfing a number of years ago. And so, I'm going to be spending a little bit more time down in Costa Rica. I invested in some real estate down there. And so I'm learning about the Costa Rican real estate market. Would love help from the bright kids at Chicago if you can help me figure that out.
We're starting a Costa Rican real estate investment fund, by the way, for those listeners that are interested in that asset class.
Yeah, it's going to be huge.
Taking checks.
Yeah. But I have a number of things that I'm like really excited. And so when Alex and I were discussing this, this is kind of where, you know, a lot of what you guys do is where my future is. So one venture that I'm trying to get off the ground would be a new technology platform. I'm working with a number of really recognized kind of Buddhist and meditation folks, and we're going to try and create a technology and kind of experiential community platform to kind of do a lot of what I experienced with like kind of optimizing your life around the hero's journey of like, you know, hey, you think you're more. You can be more, you can go do more. You do some of this, all of a sudden life doesn't really go the way you planned. Now what do? Then you think it's something else. And then finally you kind of figure that out. So I think it's probably okay to share, but Tara Brach, who's a pretty well-known podcaster and very successful globally, and then an individual by the name of Jack Kornfield. So we've got like a lot of exciting things around this, and it's just happening now. So there's that. There's a couple other things that I've done some investing in some private companies where people have come and asked for money and want my help either from a board or experiential standpoint. So that's probably what the future holds. And then, even at RAS, we did a lot with the academic community. So with Colorado State, we ran a 8 years in a row, a kind of strategy bake-off with Lockheed Martin's executive team, where the kids would be put into teams and compete, and the end of the semester, the client would pick a winner. And I love giving back like this. I my advice to your listening group and the students is like, you know, you're very smart. It's all going to happen. Let it, but really understand who you are and figure out a group of people that can help optimize that, but also kind of give you real advice back. And I think that's what I kind of wish. I don't know if my 28-year-old self would have heard any of that stuff because I was pretty thick-headed.
It's very good advice.
Yeah. Though. Not that people in finance and private equity, you know, are real, real firm in their opinions. But definitely I think that was something that unlocked a ton of just personal value and peace to go off and execute the vision that ultimately we were able to do.
Yeah. Well, as I promised in the beginning of the podcast, the story is inspirational, and Rob, it's fascinating, and I appreciate you taking the time. And
anytime.
On behalf of the Chicago Booth community and the Polsky Center, thank you for joining us and providing such valuable insight.
Well, thanks for having me. It was such a treat to have Alex here as well.
Yeah, I'm glad I was able to add so much, fellas.
No, it's fascinating to see. I can't imagine being in an MBA program now and having all of what you guys have teed up. Like, this is inspiring. I started as an engineer and then became a consultant or was going to be a banker. I think I don't know if your students understand how incredible this is. Like, it is like to come out and like have equity and do exits and, you know, cross banking, consulting, leadership, all of that. It's really cool. I mean, it's so cool.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.